I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There, the podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories outdoors. Okay, pop quiz. Where did sunglasses originate? Yeah, I didn't know the answer to that one either. I had to look it up. Turns out, all the way back in prehistoric times, Inuits made sunglasses out of walrus ivory. I guess they're not technically glasses because they don't actually have lenses in them. They're just flattened pieces of ivory that you put over your eyes to totally block out the sun. And then they've got these tiny little slits that you look out of. Anyway, fast forward to 35 years ago, when obviously sunglasses were all over the place, and there's this group of fishermen who wanted to make them better. Their goal was to be able to stay out on the water longer. So what did they do? They pioneered new lens technology to help you see below the surface of the water. Plus, they engineered hinges that would stand up to salt water and frames that would stay put on your face. And thus, Costa sunglasses came to be. Costa is one of our sponsors for this episode. They make glasses for people who want to be out on the water as much as possible. Find the perfect frame for your pursuit at costasunglasses.com. That's costasunglasses.com. And now, on to our story for today. Society places a lot of emphasis on following through with things, on finishing what you start, refusing to give up. Toughing it out is seen as a badge of honor, something to be proud of. Employers look for it when they're hiring. Many of us seek it out in our relationships. But how do you know when you've taken it too far? Where's the line between a healthy amount of perseverance and blind stubbornness? Today's story is about that. It's about figuring out when to call it quits. We're going to keep our storyteller anonymous for reasons that you'll understand later in the episode, but I'll let her take it from here.
In the running world, there's a phenomenon that is commonly referred to as a DNF. DNF are the letters that appear next to a runner's name in the race results if they choose to drop out during the race. They mean did not finish. The runner could not summon the inner strength to tough it out. The race was executed poorly, they went out too hard or too fast, or they just quit. Some runners will prefer a DNF to a slow finish time, but to me, not finishing always seemed like a failure, something to avoid at all costs. Even if the race goes terribly wrong, I finish the damn thing because I can. But last year, for the first time, I chose to take a DNF. And in a roundabout way, it might have recalculated the trajectory of my life. But before I tell you about that race, I think you might need to know my backstory. In the summer of 1998, I was a wilderness trail crew leader in central Idaho. For that summer, I was a worker, not a runner. My days were spent maintaining trails, rebuilding faded, washed-out routes, clearing fallen trees, and reconstructing bridges. It was a pivotal season for me in many ways. I was thankful to be working in the immense wilderness, pushing the physical boundaries of what my body had ever done. The experience sparked a sense of belonging and joy. But what I am sometimes impressed by in looking back on those days is just how physically brutal the job was. And yet all four of us on the crew plugged along with bruises, scars, missing fingernails, calloused hands, and with shoulders aching under the weight of 80-pound backpacks. We hiked loops over 40 miles long with giant packs laden with camping gear and trail tools. We ate crappy, dehydrated meals and ramen noodles. We spent showerless weeks working in the dirt and mud and sun and rain, swinging tools, sawing trees, moving rocks. To put it bluntly, we were badasses. But it didn't feel like we were trying to prove anything. We just did our jobs. It was what we were expected to do to earn our $9.32 an hour. There was work to do. And that was how nearly all of my seasonal jobs went for over 20 years. Sure, there were some slackers, as well as some very large egos, coworkers who felt a need to one-up everyone else. But for the most part, I just worked. We all did. After my season in Idaho, I packed mules through the Chisos Mountains in Big Bend National Park. My winter entailed using a string of 7 mules to haul supplies and food to work crews stationed throughout the mountains. Every day, I carefully loaded each mule with roughly 100 or 200 pounds of food, water, and timbers for trail construction. After delivering everything to the crews, I'd haul out their trash and scrap lumber. It was a soothing cycle with a daily rhythm I came to love. But it was not easy work. I vividly remember the day I was packing a load of supplies to Boot Cabin in a wintry storm front. The cold wind blasted my chest as the mule I was riding just slowly, slowly picked his footing through a rough section of trail. The wind seemed to penetrate directly into my lungs, which were already filled with fluid from a painful bout of bronchitis. Within a day or two, I was laid out flat with pneumonia. Even though I was unable to feed or dress myself, I still managed to crawl out of my bunkhouse and over to the corrals to feed and water the mules. There was work to do. And that was the life. Ripped off your fingernails while moving a boulder, band-aids and duct tape and go back to work. Sliced your knee open with a crosscut saw while logging out a dangerous tree? Well, finish the log, of course. There's not that much blood. Slipped 2 discs in your lower lumbar spine in a quarry accident in Tucson? Pretend it doesn't hurt that much so you won't fall behind on your masonry project. I think you get the idea. The stories and adventures span decades, and they weren't accomplished for bragging. Many were done alone and never spoken of. Until very recently, only a few photos of this part of my life were taken. No one compelled me to work through pain and injury. It was just something I did. I had learned that I could pack the pain away and keep moving. It was just life, work, and how to get things done. It became who I was. Then, about 16 years ago, I started my field season at a new office in Western Colorado. 8 months married and 7 weeks pregnant. Suddenly, I was faced with a new sense of vulnerability that I had never considered. I can do long, difficult days in the mountains, but can an unborn baby? What if I have a wreck with my pack horses? What if I fall into a creek and become hypothermic? What if there's a chainsaw accident? Suddenly, the threat seemed too real. But despite my worries, when my new supervisor offered to give me easier work, I said no. Some of the gray-haired forest staff had warned that I would surely miscarry if I rode a horse in my condition, but I also knew that babies in the womb are resilient. I had already been cleared by my doctor, so I told my supervisor that I would let him know if it became too difficult. Later that season, into October and the first mountain snows, I was riding my horse with 2 pack horses in tow into a driving, wet, slushy snow. About 6 miles up the Clear Fork, I rode into a massive band of sheep. They were bottlenecked in a rocky draw, blocking the trail. They couldn't move, so my horses couldn't get through. The temperature began to drop, changing from slush to wind-driven ice pellets. Sheep dogs barked, cold wind. The overwhelming smell of wet sheep made me nauseous. Minutes passed, and I had barely moved up the trail. My pregnant belly was so big, I hardly fit in the saddle. My baby squirmed and kicked under my ribcage. I was hungry, again, and cold. I had to pee again. At that moment, I was done. No regret, no shame. I said a very loud and distinct string of cuss words, turned my horses around, and rode back to the trailhead. The drive back was a white-knuckle mudfest, trying to keep my horse trailer from sliding off the one-lane mountain road. Finally, many hours after I had turned around, I walked into my boss's office, sat down, and asked him to lay me off for the rest of the season. I asked for this through poorly contained tears. Being the quiet old rancher type he was, he just said kindly in his slow, understated drawl, "Well, I can't believe you made it this long." This might have been my first taste of a DNF, but it didn't feel like a failure at the time. I had more than proven my ability to finish. Not only had I worked a demanding, full-time season in the mountains of Colorado while pregnant, but I had also accomplished more than the previous two young men in my job put together. I covered nearly 450,000 acres, camped overnight with my horses, used chainsaws and handsaws, and moved rocks, trees, and standards. And my baby was just fine. This was not a DNF. This was me proving that pregnant women don't have to quit or take a desk job. In the next 3 years came three children. Although I was able to eventually resume part-time fieldwork, I found myself restless and stressed as a stay-at-home mom. When time allowed, I began running again. I had been a runner on and off since I was young, but had never taken it too seriously. As a self-conscious teen, I'd run alone out on the trails or in the cover of night. Now, as a new mother, I picked up the sport again and entered my first 5K race. That led me down the path of road racing and marathon running, and I realized that this was becoming a passion. I started running longer and longer miles in the high desert lands and canyons near my home. These runs brought me joy, focus, clarity, and a much-deserved break from my responsibilities as a mom. I started completing even longer distances, 50-mile and 50K races through the mountains and deserts of Colorado and Utah. It was a busy time in my life. I was raising three amazing kids, taking care of the gardening, the bills, the shopping, the household responsibility, the special needs dog. Plus, I was holding down a part-time job with 14-hour days in the mountains and pursuing a four-semester undergraduate certificate. In an ideal world, through all of that, I would have had the love and support and friendship of my husband. He would have been there to celebrate my accomplishments, encourage me in my endeavors, and hold my hand through the dark hours of doubt. But it didn't turn out that way. My marriage was not full of loving partnership or friendship, and it was becoming clear that it never would be. My largest challenge at these ultras and tough trail running events was not the physical brutality, but the emotional letdown of finishing alone. Watching the lady who I ran past in the last mile finish the race with a kiss from her husband and her kids' hands in her own as she crossed the finish line would break me down into quiet sobbing in the parking lot. I had run the race faster, but those smiling children and the sincere affection meant that she had won. Where was my family? All around me were families, supportive spouses, engaged fathers with strollers and baby backpacks, happily yelling words of encouragement, finish line kids learning the thrill of accomplishment and the rewards of dedication. I was so alone. My husband did take the kids to a few races at first, but then he complained that it was too hard for him to watch the kids while I was running. So they stopped coming to cheer me on, even though my kids had enjoyed being included. If I was going to continue to run in events, I would have to do it alone.
Hey, it's Willow. We'll hear the rest of the story in just a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor. Support for Out There comes from Wild Woman. Wild Woman is a monthly subscription for, well, wild women. What is a wild woman, you ask? Founder Alexandra DeRusio says being wild does not necessarily mean being the most hardcore adventurer out there. Instead, it means embracing all your different roles in life.
I feel like women are often pigeonholed into needing to choose an identity, like, oh, you're a mom, or oh, you're a hiker, or you're an artist, or, you know, we kind of are pushed into choosing a singular identity. But I feel like there's something really empowering and freeing about saying a wild woman is a woman who is everything she wants to be.
With that in mind, Alexandra makes sure Wild Woman boxes contain everything from outdoor gear to natural beauty products to words of inspiration to yummy things you can eat. When you subscribe to Wild Woman, you'll get one of these boxes in the mail each month delivered right to your door. For 15% off your subscription, go to wildwomanboxes.com and enter the promo code OUTTHERE at checkout. That's wildwomanboxes.com, promo code OUTTHERE. And just FYI, OUTTHERE gets a small percentage of all sales that are made with that promo code. So by subscribing to Wild Woman with the promo code OUTTHERE, you'll be treating yourself and helping this podcast. And now, back to the story.
When my husband and I met, he was a runner too. But when I became faster than him and more serious about the sport, he suddenly lost interest. He refused to run with me. And he often made it difficult for me to get out on the trails. He would promise to take the kids to a movie so I could go for a long run, then announce he needed to nap at the very moment I was about to leave the house. And of course, I would bail on my run to stay with the kids. I started getting up at 4 a.m. to squeeze in my long runs before the kids were awake. Then my early morning schedule became a source of resentment. If I signed up for a running event, I received scowls, not encouragement. He eyed my running companions with suspicion and never offered to get to know them. It wasn't just the running that he quietly sabotaged. My work, my passions, my accomplishments. He had no interest in any of it. For years, I gave up my own work and education goals to make it possible for him to accomplish his own. My work schedule had to be flexible enough to allow for his extensive travel. When he spent thousands of dollars and many hours working on online classes, I supported him in every way I knew how. But when it came to my desires, my goals, my dreams and aspirations, he offered nothing back except resentment, boredom. So many times he would come home and talk about his day, but never ask about mine. If I told him anyway, he wouldn't even look up from his phone. Over time, I started believing that I was boring. If he was that disinterested in me, it must be because I had nothing worthwhile to say. Maybe having interests and goals made me selfish. I stopped trying to reach out for friendship and support. He simply wasn't going to offer that. Our relationship became tense, distant, and painfully hollow. In hindsight, there were so many red flags in my marriage. But in my mind, you don't quit. Those many years of living and working in the wilderness reaffirmed that I could tough out nearly anything if there was work to do. And my job was to provide the most stable situation that I could for my children. My feelings and sense of emotional detachment could be smoothed over with duct tape and grit. My kids needed me to tough it out. Last year, despite the turbulence of 15 years of an increasingly difficult marriage, I decided to see if I could be more competitive in my running. My first attempt at pushing my pace in a trail race, after many years of just being out there for the experience, was at the Dead Horse 30K in Moab, Utah. I came in first in my age group, and I was hooked on that feeling of accomplishment. My next race, also in Moab, resulted in almost a 20-minute course personal best. Then I came in second overall woman at a Moab 25K. Granted, these were small events, but it felt as though I was rediscovering the joy of pushing my physical capabilities. I decided that I had time for one more race before my job started up again. The field season, my wilderness work with its 12 to 14 hour days in the mountains, always marked a shift in focus from miles spent running to miles spent working in the mountains. Running season was drawing to a close. I settled on the NORAD Trail Marathon in Colorado Springs. Not long after I signed up for the marathon, I began having painful spasms in my hip, buttock, and low back. That lower lumbar injury from the quarry accident in Tucson, it still causes problems. But this time, I frequently found myself 5 miles, 8 miles, out from the trailhead with my entire left leg seized up and stiff. I had to fight to flex my knee. I would hobble back for miles, fighting tears and frustration. It was a terrible feeling, having lost control of my own body. I tried physical therapy, strength training, and an anti-inflammatory diet. Those things helped enough to make the symptoms subside. And as race weekend arrived, I decided to take the gamble that I could run a marathon. I looked at the entrant list and felt confident I could win my age division if my injury held up. The morning of the race brought a cool, foggy, intermittent drizzle. While that forecast might seem dismal for a hike, in my opinion, those are near perfect conditions for racing. The first loop of the two-loop course was going pretty well. I was pacing conservatively and trying to plan for a faster second loop. Near the end of the first loop, though, the drizzle deteriorated into a steady rain, and the footing became more challenging. The clay soil was turning into heavy, sticky, irregular clods that stuck to the soles of my shoes. By the time I reached the start of the second loop, I could feel the familiar warning signs of my lingering injury. A sharp pain began to radiate out from my spine, across my left buttock, and all the way down to my knee. It felt as though someone was holding an electrical current to my skin. My leg tingled and began to become stiff. Was it worth it? I could drop out halfway through. I would still have run a half marathon. Or I could stick it out and finish the full marathon. I had been through worse. I was not bleeding or unconscious. I also knew that sometimes mysterious aches and pains could appear, then suddenly disappear after a few miles. Maybe I'd be fine. I decided to keep going. The footing was even worse in the climb up to the 16-mile aid station. My leg was continuing to tighten up, and I was getting a deep chill from the rain. I hit the next aid station, where some cold, wet volunteers were handing out water and snacks. I confessed my dilemma. Despite the cheery encouragement of another runner, it was becoming clear that the pain wasn't going away. It was very real, and I was fully aware of how much worse it could be. This was an injury to be treated with respect. I had put in far too much work towards healing to race it all for one run. As much as I hated the idea of it, I decided to drop out of the race. I had a slow jog back to the finish line to think about my decision. I won't lie, I still questioned my choice. Maybe I could have finished without affecting my injury. Couldn't I have just stuck it out? Am I going soft? The next day, I confided to a runner friend that I had chosen to DNF. I was expecting some teasing or sympathetic disappointment. But instead, To my surprise, he told me how proud he was of me for my decision. He went on to gently point out that I have more than proven my ability to tough out and finish in situations where more rational people would have quit, almost to a fault. What I had not proven until then was that I could also make choices which, though difficult in the moment, would enable me to come back stronger. The fact that I had been able to recognize that toughing out the race would be potentially harmful to myself and choosing to do what was best for me in the long run was far more valuable than winning or finishing the race broken. I have to admit that this gave me pause. Maybe I have been thinking about this the wrong way. Maybe sometimes dropping out of the race is the best possible outcome. In the backdrop of this DNF was the slow train wreck of a marriage going off the rails. My trust was gone. My affection towards my husband was also gone. And yet I held on. In hindsight, I think I stayed so long because I craved stability. I felt as though I had to provide an intact home for my kids. But after this race, I started to question that idea. I wondered if I was teaching my kids that marriage is loveless, tense, and stressful. That they should stick out tough relationships despite the harm to their own hearts. That it is okay to sacrifice your own need for love and affection as some kind of greater family martyrdom. That is not what I want to teach my children about love. The notion of leaving had been simmering for several years, but I had been unable to face the reality of quitting. Somehow the very idea of taking control of the situation had seemed laughable. I could never just walk away, could I? The weight of financial and emotional hardships pressed down. Maybe I could just hang in there for a little while longer. But under the confusing swirl of chatter was a deep, lonely ache in my heart, which I knew would not heal if I continued in my current situation. The wounds would only become worse. So, despite the self-doubt and voices asking why I couldn't just stick it out until the kids were grown, a few months after the failed race in Colorado Springs, I gathered my courage and filed for divorce. It was my second DNF. As counter to my nature as it might seem, I'm starting to see taking a DNF as an opportunity to rebuild and rebound, to change the trajectory of my life. It's not evidence of weakness or poor execution of a plan. The DNF is just a pause, a way to step back, recalculate, heal. There is a resilient beauty in choosing to come back stronger, in recognizing that relentless forward motion might not always take you in the best direction. There's an adage that says that no one ever crosses the same river twice. The waters are always new, and the person is always changed. To me, the point is that I will come back to cross that river someday. I'm not done with running or racing or mountains or love. And when I do approach the river again, it will be with a renewed sense of tenacity and grit, and perhaps a bit more wisdom and humility. It's okay to take time to heal, to take an honest assessment of my condition, to reconsider the risks and the priorities. As long as it moves me forward to new places, new adventures, as long as I can come back a little more whole. After all, there's still work to do.
At As I mentioned at the start of this episode, we're keeping today's storyteller anonymous. That's because at the time of recording, her divorce proceedings were not yet finalized. If you're enjoying Out There, please consider making a financial contribution to the show. We welcome gifts in any amount. If you're trying to figure out what would be a good amount for you, maybe take a moment and think about how much each episode is worth to you. Is Out There worth $1 a month? $5? $10? Whatever you think we're worth, please make a contribution in that amount. Just head over to patreon.com/outtherepodcast to become a patron today. And by the way, Patreon is a crowdfunding platform for creative endeavors. Again, that's patreon.com/outtherepodcast, and you can also get there through our website, outtherepodcast.com. Your support makes this show possible. That's it for this episode. Our marketing and business development director is Alex Egerking. Our advertising coordinator is Jessica Taylor. Laura Johnston heads up our ambassador program. And our theme music was written by Jared Arnold. We'll see you in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.